This is Gavel to Gavel Alaska, a service of public television station KTOO in Juneau.
The Honorable Justices of the Supreme Court of the State of Alaska.
Please proceed. Good morning, and this is the time set for oral argument in Bigley versus API. Are you ready to proceed? Mr. Gottstein?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. Madam Chief Justice, may it please the court. This is an appeal of a psychiatric forced drugging order under AS 473839. But the first thing I want to bring to the court's attention is that there's a pending emergency motion regarding a violation of the court stay that was issued in this court in May. The court granted the stay on the grounds that Mr. Bigley would face the danger of irreparable harm, and API was adequately protected. And the state sought full court reconsideration of that stay, among other things, stating that that the stay should be lifted because API couldn't drug Mr. Bigley, during this or any future commitment period. The court denied reconsideration, but then ordered the parties to address whether this appeal should be expedited. API did not respond to that order, but Mr. Bigley did, saying that the appeal should be expedited, not because API couldn't drug him during the interim, but because he has difficulties in the community and he needs this less intrusive alternative that is being sought. And if that wasn't granted, because API has this practice of if it can't drug him, they won't do anything and they just discharge him. And that's exactly what happened. A number of times he got arrested and then he was regularly those charges are dismissed because he's found incompetent to stand trial and unrestorable. A number of times referred to API, which immediately discharged him because they felt the stay prevented them from drugging him. And then, although the record isn't entirely clear on this, because of community pressure about the trouble that was being caused in the community, API decided to go ahead and file a forced drugging petition. And we brought that up, that the stay, and the Superior Court proceeded anyway. We said it should be brought to this court to decide whether it applied. The Superior Court proceeded and granted the stay. So we filed an emergency motion to strike the petition. This is in this case, to strike the petition and vacate the forced drugging order in that case. And I think that was fashioned as a motion to enforce the stay. And what the Superior Court did in this case is stay its decision until the end of the day today. And so if by the end of the day today this court doesn't act, then they'll start forced drugging again tomorrow. There's also an issue with respect to the police power drugging, but that's kind of being dealt in the new appeal, which I had to file a new appeal, it's S-13353, and filed for an emergency stay there. And this basically the same thing is true there, although they're now operating under the idea that they can drug them under the police power right now. So I wanted to bring that to the court's attention because just so the court knows that if there's no action today, then that stay that this court ordered in May, in my view, is going to be violated. So to the substantive parts of this case and the merits of this case, there are, I think, four dispositive issues But the one that I really want to focus on is Mr. Bigley's request that this court order the API to provide a less intrusive alternative. There was essentially unrebutted evidence of a less intrusive alternative that could be employed if API was ordered to provide it, or and of course some other agency could actually provide it. They could subcontract it out or something like that. And I wanted to discuss a little bit the cornerstone of the less intrusive alternative is to have someone with Mr. Bigley in the community. He's very angry at what's happened to him over 28 years of forced drugging and the guardianship basically taking away all his rights. He has trouble in the community, and he yells at people. And he talks constantly in a way that people consider delusional, and I think probably, and some of it clearly is. You really have to kind of spend some time with him to really understand. But if he had someone with him in the community, there's testimony, Paul Cornell's testimony in particular, who spent a considerable amount of time working with him in the community before funding ran out, basically. He testified that he would probably do quite well in the community if he had that kind of support.
But didn't Mr. Cornell's also testify that even your plan couldn't work unless he was willing to follow the medication orders of a treating doctor?
No, what he said, and there's actually been some subsequent development of that, and that was one of the things I raised in my due process argument, is what he said was that the medical director wouldn't accept him if he was not following his physician's advice to take medication. So that doesn't prevent API from providing it. And then subsequent developments were that really wasn't the position, it's the organization's choices, but that really the issue is that the choices medical director was not willing to take primary responsibility in terms of being on call because there's only one of them. So there needs to be another physician involved. So that's one of the issues I think involved in due process, because I was surprised by that testimony, and I could have brought someone in that would have said, no, that's not true. Choices would take him, but he has to have a physician that has primary responsibility, which is a function that API could provide to be the physician. But whether or not Choices could do it, it's clear that API could do it.
Well, does the least restrictive alternative or the less restrictive alternative have to be a therapeutic alternative, or can it be just something that controls the behavior on a temporal basis?
Well, I think there's a real question about how therapeutic the drugs are, frankly, and whether or not, as Dr. Jackson testified, their true value is in controlling behavior as well. And there was unrebutted testimony that the drugs actually are counter-therapeutic, citing a lot of scientific evidence, that they reduce recovery rates and they cause brain damage. And Mr. Bigley's current behavior is almost certainly due to the brain damage caused by almost 30 years of drugs, starting with a massive dose of Haldol in 1980 or 1981, massive doses of Haldol. But to get more directly to your question, both Sarah Porter in her testimony that was submitted in writing and Paul Cornell's testified that this really is a therapeutic approach, and it's a way to over time get him to, it's not a certainty, but over time get him to a point where he could possibly function in the community with far, far fewer supports. And the point is, I think, that what API has done over 28 years hasn't worked. It isn't working. He quits taking the drugs every time he's discharged, and he should be given the opportunity to take this other approach. And I would really suggest the court take a very close look at Mr. Cornell's testimony about his interaction with him in the community and Sarah Porter's testimony about her experience in New Zealand. She was qualified as an expert in alternative care, and how this non-coercive approach is far more therapeutic than the current approach.
Mr. Gossian, I read Mr. Cornell's testimony, and it's clear that he's very sympathetic to your client and that he sees a lot of problems with the approach that API is taking. But was the trial judge required to give credence to the efficacy of that approach, I might say the hopeful testimony that it might work over the testimony of the doctors from API that say it's clearly outside of the mainstream and we don't think it's going to work?
Well, I think that there's no question that it's not, quote, the current standard of care. But if you look at the standard of care, I mean, if you look at what this unrebutted scientific evidence is that it prevents it that people who are not on the drugs do far better over the long term, and that they cause a lot of damage. And so another way to look at that is that API's response was, well, yeah, but that's what we do. That's the standard of care. And I think in Myers, this court really made clear that what we're about today here is a legal decision about rights. It's not about standard of care. And standard of care, I think, really is an issue in negligence actions. It's not really an issue in with respect to a person's constitutional rights. And where you have a standard of care that really goes against this massive amount of evidence, which API has had before it since Myers. I mean, it's been kind of increasingly refined. But the studies that are cited in the Myers, in Robert Whitaker's affidavit, were submitted to the court in Myers and were submitted here. And they've never even attempted to rebut it. They don't rebut it. And I don't think it really is possible to rebut it because the scientific evidence is clear. So
If we were to accept your arguments, would it ever be appropriate to force medication on a patient? Is there a set of circumstances where the state could prove the need and the fact that there would be no less intrusive?
I hate to make categorical statements like that.
But just functionally.
But I think that I know people that find the medications helpful, and I think that they should be, you know, they should be available to them and they should use them. But when, especially someone who's experienced them, they know. And when you have,
I guess
this,
the question is involuntary medication ever possible under your argument?
I was getting to that. Thank you. I'm sorry for taking so long. I think that in light of this evidence about the harm and the lack of efficacy, that it would be very hard to do that under the clear and convincing principle. And I think that if that approach was taken, especially if you look at Dr. Lauren Mosier's testimony from Myers, that it would be very beneficial for the patients to stop the coercion. It's just so counter-therapeutic.
For every one of those folks who are facing involuntary medication who would oppose it because the lesser intrusive alternative would be entitled to an apartment, would be entitled to have API staff go with them wherever they want to go, would be entitled to come and go at API whenever they please?
No, I don't. Absolutely not, Your Honor. I think that the API says that Mr. Bigley is one of the most mentally ill people in the state, and he's the third all-time resident at API over years. And so I think in this, the less intrusive alternative that is suggested here was really fashioned for specifically for him, and I think that you would look at the circumstances in each case, and that I think the cost would be, you know, an issue. It certainly shouldn't be an unreasonable cost. No, I don't think, especially providing housing in most cases, that's very, I wouldn't ask for that in most cases. It's a specific circumstances in this case where the guardian is spending so much of his money on housing that he only has $10 a day. And what I'm really, and there are housing subsidies that are available from the from various government programs that a lot of people get. And I think that the state should, you know, really work on getting one of those subsidies, housing subsidies, so that Mr. Bigley has a reasonable, you know, amount of spending money. He gets almost $1,500 a month, or over $1,500 a month in Social Security. So, but then they spend, I don't know, maybe, well, then they take a bunch of it out because of this and that. But the result is he only has $10 a day in spending money or less as a result of how much money they're spending on housing. So it's a unique situation, I think, and I would say that that would be extremely rare that to require the provision of housing.
Mr. Gottstein, if you're talking about cost, I understood your proposal, your less restrictive alternative, to be that API take him as necessary when he appears there, and that there also be separate housing for him that's maintained by the person who's delegated to be with him on a 24-hour basis. That sounds way more expensive than the current regime.
Well, they currently charge patients over $1,000 a day, so I think there's room there, and he spent a lot of time in the hospital, a lot of time in jail. So in comparison, not so much. But really, the housing issue really at API only comes into play when he loses his housing. If he's got housing, then that doesn't come into play. And I think that's the key here. He's banned from Brother Francis because they want him to apologize, and he won't apologize. And so he really doesn't have any options. So I kind of characterize that as housing of last resort. And the guardian should really, in API, and everybody should really work on finding a housing placement that he'll be able to maintain. And then that provision wouldn't even apply. But the point on that is that I think that it's not good for the only time Mr. Bigley to go to API is at the point where he's so bad that people are worried about him in the community. And that, I think, really is a certain level of insanity. And we ought to make it a point where, you know, if it comes to that, he doesn't have housing and he's going to get in trouble. We know he's going to get in trouble. Let him go to API. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Plumey.
May it please the Court. My name is Tim Toomey. I'm here representing Alaska Psychiatric Institute this morning, and I thank you for this opportunity to speak. This is an important case. It's an important case for Mr. Bigley, and it's an important case for this court. It's a big day for Mr. Bigley. Unfortunately, his condition prevents him from being here today and participating, but it is important and a big day because it presents an opportunity for hope for Mr. Bigley, hope that he will receive treatment for his mental illness, and it presents an opportunity for this court to do justice. And by that, I mean addressing the issue of Mr. Bigley's liberty. That's what we're here about. That's what we're discussing today. And that's the legal issue before this court. We have to keep in mind that Mr. Bigley has been found gravely disabled because of his mental illness. His mental illness has taken his liberty away. Mr. Bigley is not able to survive safely in a free environment. He has been committed at API based upon a finding supported by clear and convincing evidence that he was unable to survive safely in a free environment. So we can't lose fact sight of that fact. A proposal of a less restrictive alternative, which ignores the fact of Mr. Bigley's commitment, is unrealistic. It's unrealistic because it ignores the fact that Mr. Bigley cannot survive safely without a whole heck of a lot of support. The proposal for a less intrusive treatment or a less restrictive alternative proposed on behalf of Mr. Bigley ignores the fact of his commitment. It also is not therapeutic, and it does not provide therapy within the institution. We're here dealing with a committed patient, committed involuntarily. API has a duty to treat such patients, and they follow the law in this case. sought court approval, independent court oversight over their recommendation to provide medicine to Mr. Bigley. We believe that the trial court properly considered the evidence, the arguments both pro and against the medication that's being proposed in this case, carefully considered the alternatives to those medications, including a variety of other medications that could be used, non-medication alternatives, and the no-treatment alternative. And it was the testimony of the doctors who were willing to treat Mr. Bigley that medicines are required in his case, that without medicines, Mr. Bigley will not have any prospect of recovering to the point where he can again have some liberty and make his own health care decisions. With medicines, based on prior experiences with Mr. Bigley, Mr. Bigley's been able to sustain himself at a higher level of function in the community, albeit for short periods of time. It is hoped that through the administration of therapeutic medicines to Mr. Bigley, he will receive some relief from the symptoms that he suffers from, including delusions, believing that his food and water are poisoned, believing that medicines that are being proposed by his healthcare providers are poison. We have to talk about what it means to Mr. Bigley here when we're talking about his liberty. This is not a case about forced drugging. It's not a case about Mr. Bigley's commitment. The commitment itself has not been challenged. It is not a case about the evils of these drugs, although the trial court did receive all of the evidence offered on behalf of Mr. Bigley. This is not a case where this court is asked to outlaw psychotropic medication. We have a statutory scheme that permits the use of psychotropic medicines under limited circumstances with court oversight, and the trial court in this case followed the guidance given in the Myers decision when reaching its conclusion that the administration of this one medicine to Mr. Bigley was in his best interest and would give him some hope for regaining his liberty. Now, Mr. Gottstein has indicated that there is a less restrictive alternative that's available, and he referred to the testimony of Paul Cornelius. I think the record is clear that Mr. Cornelius' testimony was that his organization, Choices, was unable to serve Mr. Bigley at the present time because Mr. Bigley is noncompliant with his health care provider's recommendations to take medicine. Certainly, it's appropriate to have community support for Mr. Bigley, but again, this alternative that was proposed and discussed and considered by the trial court ignores the fact of Mr. Bigley's commitment. It ignores API's obligation to provide therapeutic treatment to its patients while they are committed at the facility. There was a valid debate that was presented to the trial court and considered concerning the efficacy of such alternatives. It was a testimony of the healthcare providers presented by API that medicine was required, that this proposed medicine is within the medical standard of care, and in fact, the medical standard of care requires the administration of this medicine to Mr. Bigley, given his serious condition. The Myers factors were considered by the trial court. The diagnosis and prognosis of Mr. Bigley's symptoms with and without the medications were considered. The changes in Mr. Bigley's behavior were discussed. Information about the medicines was presented to the court, including expert testimony from Mr. Bigley's expert, Dr. Grace Jackson, who is a recognized authority on researching these medicines and their potential side effects. The court considered that evidence and weighed that evidence and believed that the evidence was clear and convincing that this medicine, despite the risks of side effects that were presented and considered, was appropriate in Mr. Bigley's case. Mr. Bigley has been on medicines in the past. He has not experienced some of the side effects that were discussed or presented as possible side effects. So we can't lose sight of the fact that we have specific experience with Mr. Bigley on these medicines, and that he did well in the past. Testimony is that Mr. Bigley is not doing well now. He's done better in the past. He is on a declining course. And as I said, we have an opportunity today to give Mr. Bigley some hope of receiving medical treatment and some hope of regaining his liberty. A treatment treats a problem that may lead to its cure, but treatments more often ameliorate a problem only for as long as the treatment is continued. Treatments don't always work. As an example, chemotherapy is a treatment for some forms of cancer, but it does not always effectuate a cure. In this case, the treatment that we are recommending that is the court approve, and which the trial court did approve, will ameliorate Mr. Bigley's symptoms and lessen his suffering from this mental illness. This is an important case, but it's not a difficult case. It's not difficult because the evidence presented to the trial court overwhelmingly supports the trial court's order. This is not a case about the legality of psychotropic medicines. No statute has been challenged on constitutional grounds in this case. As I said, we have to give Mr. Bigley the respect that he deserves by providing him with medically appropriate treatment. Testimony in the trial court was that there were no other therapeutic alternatives that would alleviate his symptoms. We would like to see Mr. Bigley regain some ability to function outside of the institutional environment that he finds himself in. Dr. Kari, the physician who was attending to Mr. Bigley, testified that even one day without symptoms would be better for Mr. Bigley than his current condition of no relief from his symptoms. Without the administration of medicine, Mr. Bigley's mental illness is affecting his liberty. He has continued to be involved with the police. He's had several police contacts. He's received emergency medication as a result of those incarcerations. And he has repeatedly been committed to API involuntarily. With the administration of medicines, it's our belief that he has some hope at sustaining himself on the outside of the institution. Mr. Bigley has deteriorated far enough for long enough, and we believe that the trial court did what it felt was appropriate based upon the evidence that was presented, both medically and legally. Medically, the evidence supported the treatment that was being proposed. Legally, the court followed the Myers factors, even went beyond the Myers factors, and talked about the extent and duration of changes in Mr. Bigley's behavior, the risk of adverse side effects, the fact that this treatment is not experimental in nature. It could be said that the alternative that was proposed is in fact experimental in nature and would be prohibited under our statutes prohibiting experimental treatment. The proposed treatment by medication is accepted within the medical community of this state and in every other state in this country. The extent of intrusion and pain associated with this treatment was also discussed. Even Mr. Bigley's experts themselves admit that this medicine addresses the symptoms of the disease when they talk about changes in behavior. In addition to that, Dr. Jackson, who was the plaintiff's expert on the dangers of these medicines, indicated that she was hesitant to diagnose Mr. Bigley. She had not met Mr. Bigley, had not reviewed all of his medical records, and did not want to diagnose him in a haphazard fashion. Yet she offered testimony about the potential dangers of these drugs in a general fashion. The court considered that. It's clear from the court's order. We don't need to speculate as to what the court considered. The court made it explicit in the order, telling us about the evidence that was presented, the evidence about the risks of side effects associated with these medicines. Nevertheless, determined that it was in Mr. Bigley's best interest, both from a medical standpoint and from a legal standpoint, in that it gives him the best hope of regaining some liberty, liberty from the symptoms of his disease, and physical liberty in terms of some ability to function outside of an institutionalized setting. That's where we would like to see Mr. Bigley. We would like to see him regain some function, because we know that in the past, when compliant with medicine, he was able to sustain himself on the outside, albeit for intermittent periods of time. API seeks guidance from this court, not only with respect to Mr. Bigley, which today we're here discussing a May 2008 commitment and petition for administration of medicine, but 6 months have passed and Mr. Bigley has again been committed involuntarily to API, and a second Superior Court judge has heard evidence similar to the evidence presented in the May petition pertaining to the administration of medicine, and again has found that the proposed medicine is in Mr. Bigley's best interest. That, we anticipate, will be appealed on behalf of Mr. Bigley, but we're looking for some guidance from this court. If the evidence presented in May was not sufficient to sustain a clear and convincing burden, then API questions what evidence would be sufficient in order to administer psychotropic medication to an involuntarily committed patient who is unwilling to accept that medicine. Clearly, our statutes, public policy of this state, provides for the use of these medicines. It's a serious matter, and I believe that API followed the law to the letter in this case by seeking independent court review of its proposed treatment plan for Mr. Bigley. Mr. Bigley has raised some due process concerns or challenges in association with this appeal, but if the court examines the record, the court will find that those due process concerns are not supported by the record. The trial court gave Mr. Bigley and his counsel several opportunities to present additional evidence. Counsel was questioned concerning how much time he needed to present evidence. He responded, and that time was given.
Mr. Toomey, let me ask you about that. Yes. Why didn't Mr. Gottstein get the medical charts earlier, the medical chart earlier in this case?
Well, there was some, I hesitate to say confusion, but there were multiple counsel involved on behalf of Mr. Bigley. Public Defender's Office was appointed to represent Mr. Bigley initially. Public Defender's Office and Mr. Gottstein became embroiled in a dispute over who was going to represent Mr. Bigley, and Mr. Gottstein took the position that he was representing Mr. Bigley with respect to the petition for administration of medication only. There was a representation hearing concerning that issue, and it was determined that the public defender would represent Mr. Bigley through the commitment phase of this proceeding, and then Mr. Gottstein would assume representation. He filed a limited entry of appearance purporting to represent Mr. Bigley on the medication issue alone. So when the medication petition became ripe after the commitment was ordered, Mr. Gottstein appeared, and that's when the chart was provided to Mr. Gottstein. He made a request for it, and it was provided to him at the beginning of the proceedings, and the court indicated that it was going to begin with API's presentation of evidence, and it would give Mr. Gottstein additional time to present his evidence.
Let me just stop you there. I understand that it's an unusual situation. I think it's an unusual situation to have one attorney for commitment purposes and another for medication purposes, but why wouldn't the materials be made available at the outset of the case?
Well, at the outset of the case, first of all, a medical chart had not been developed. The medical chart represents the period of time that Mr. Bigley is committed at the facility. And we had concerns in terms of who we were appropriately communicating with concerning Mr. Bigley and his medical information. Certainly that information could be obtained through Mr. Bigley's counsel of record in the commitment proceedings. I don't know whether Mr. Gottstein made any effort to obtain that information or not through Mr. Bigley's co-counsel, if you will. So, again, we believe that adequate time was provided by the trial court. Notice of this proceeding was provided both to Mr. Bigley and to two sets of attorneys, Public Defender's Office and Mr. Gottstein. Mr. Gottstein has not offered or did not offer to the trial court any suggestion or offer of proof as to what additional witnesses he would like to call. He's raised an issue here today for the first time, indicating that he was surprised by his own witness's testimony, Paul Cornelius, and that if he had additional time, he could have cured that surprise testimony. Well, there was no effort made in the trial court to cure that so-called surprise. There were no additional witnesses sought to be called. The trial court did not exclude any of it.
He said in his brief that he was surprised by Mr. Cornelius' testimony.
Pardon me?
Mr. Gottstein actually said in his brief that he was surprised by Mr. Cornelius.
Well, he may well have been surprised, but he did not do anything at the time to attempt to cure that surprise by calling an additional witness or requesting additional time from the court.
I was just commenting on your statement that he made that claim for the first time today.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. He didn't make that claim in the trial court, I think is my point. In summary, this is an important case. It's an important case that addresses individual rights, individual freedom, but you have to ask yourself, what does that mean in Mr. Bigley's case? This is a person whose freedom has been affected by the course of his mental illness. We're not talking about taking Mr. Bigley's freedom away here today. His freedom or his ability to survive safely in society has been taken away by his mental illness. We would like to provide some treatment for his illness. We have an opportunity to do that. It gives him some hope of regaining his legal rights to liberty, which are being affected by his mental illness and his the problems that that leads him into. As I said, this is an important case, but it need not be a difficult one. I believe that the trial court record adequately supports the administration of psychotropic medication for Mr. Bigley, limited as the court's order is. I believe that it is appropriate, and we ask that this court affirm the trial court's order so that we can begin to provide therapeutic treatment to Mr. Bigley.
Thank you, Mr. Toomey.
Thank you, Mr.
Gottstein.
Thank you, Your Honors. I think the most important thing here is that after 28 years and 75 admissions at the time of this hearing of a failed process of forced drugging, whether you agree that the drugs are good or not, it's a process that's clearly not working, and that Mr. Bigley really ought to be given a chance to try this other approach, for which there's really unrebutted testimony in support of.
Mr. Gottstein, with regard to your due process claim, can you tell me specifically what you asked for at the trial court level that you did not get from a procedural standpoint, and what harm that caused you?
Well, I indicated I was going to I would like to file a summary judgment motion, for example, and
How are you harmed by that if you actually went to a hearing and had a full-blown evidentiary hearing and a decision on the merits?
Well, I think that really brings up this issue of, and Mr. Toomey mentioned, you know, what evidence would be sufficient, and I think it's this scientific evidence that we've presented and we've been presenting for years now that has never been rebutted. And I think that it's incumbent upon API to come in and
say... Well, now you're talking substance again, and I want to talk about procedural due process, if you don't mind. From a procedural due process, which is your claim here, specifically what did you ask for from a procedural due process perspective that you were denied at the trial court level?
Well, I asked for more time. And then the other thing was there was
Okay, let's start with more time. Did you get no more time?
I didn't get any more time to prepare for cross-examination.
Okay, so it was time to prepare for cross. And can you just point to anything in the record where you objected specifically that says, you know, if you'd have given me more time, I could do more?
Yes, and I think I pointed some, I pointed out some in the brief. I'm not sure what I pointed out to the court at the time. But, for example, Dr. Kari testified that she didn't know why Mr. Bigley quit voluntarily taking the same medication in October 2006, I think it was. And so I didn't have an opportunity to go present that. And it turns out, and it's in the judicial notice appendix, that medication, which they're now proposing, quit working from API's perspective, they decided to add another neuroleptic and what's called a mood stabilizer. Seroquel and Depakote is a mood stabilizer. And at that point, Mr. Bigley quit taking it voluntarily. And she didn't know that. And I didn't have an opportunity to present that evidence, which, of course, is one of the Myers factors, is the history of the medication, which is this precise medication that they are proposing previously had been determined was insufficient.
Well, how would you have known ahead of time to go prepare for that?
Well, I would have. I like to take depositions of the witnesses to know what I should prepare for, and so that's what I would have done.
Okay. Did you ask the court for permission to take depositions?
I believe that I did, Your Honor.
You believe you did or you did?
I think that I did. I'd have to go back and look at the record. I think that I did. But
anything else besides requests for depositions to go so that you could prepare for cross-examination?
Well, and then the other was, more time to look at the chart and prepare for that. Oh, the other thing was that I wanted to know what the basis of their petition was. So, for example, I didn't know what drug they were proposing until the date of the hearing. Is when the first time they disclosed what drug they were proposing, which is one of the Myers, I think, implicit in the Myers decision. And then the trial court complained that my expert witness wasn't directly addressing Risperdal when we had no notice that Risperdal was the drug in question.
Let's suppose for a moment that you're extremely persuasive in your due process argument, so we would hold that there was a due process violation. What would be the result of that in this case?
I think it'd be an important precedent, and it wouldn't give Mr. Bigley any real relief, and that's why this less intrusive alternative is the most important. For a relief to Mr. Bigley, whether or not the court orders a less intrusive alternative is the most important thing. In terms of precedent, and giving people, I think, a fair shake in the trial court, I think the due process argument is very important. It's probably important for him maybe in future cases, because if no less intrusive alternative is provided, there's hardly any doubt that it'll be there until these drugs eventually kill him, which is what Dr. Jackson testified will happen within 5 years.
But in terms of the precedent you'd like us to set in this regard, what you're asking for is that the state be required to state the diagnosis, why the medication is needed, the specific meds proposed, and the dosage. Is that correct?
I think that somehow before the hearing, in enough time to prepare, I ought to know what their case is on the Myers factors. So I think they ought to say why it's in their best interest, what his history is, just because how else can I prepare unless I know what their case is?
What did you get by way of notice? Simply the form with the two boxes checked?
Yes. Were both boxes checked?
Both were.
Yeah. Yes. Thank you.
Thank you. And thanks to both counsel. This matter under advisement. We stand in recess until 1:30. Until 11 o'clock.